On Thursday, June 6th, we talked to a high-profile attorney and author who's right in the middle of a legal battle with big pharmaceutical companies regarding opioids. Also, we talked to a historian and Yale graduate who looked into one of the most famous yet unrecognized units of World War II. The guest is radio host, lawyer, author, the author of Law and Addiction, Mike Papantonio. So, Mike, talk about your background more here, and what made you segue here from a lawyer involved in these cases to an author?
Well, in the early days, of course, we actually launched the tobacco litigation nationally from my law firm, and I watched that develop, and what was very clear is it's very difficult for people to keep up with complex cases because, you know, they got lives. They have to take care of their family. Mm-hmm. They got to make sure they take care of their job. They're busy. And so what was really apparent to me was that in order to tell some of these stories, you have to put it in a way that's entertaining, where they can walk away from it, Paul, and say, yeah, it was a great story, but I also learned something. I learned how this whole opioid crisis took place. It wasn't by accident. It was by design. And that's the same way we tell the tobacco story. And, the pharmaceutical cases always are kind of a backstory that people really they don't get a chance to hear. Media is not the greatest source for understanding what the backstory is on something like opioid, this entire opioid epidemic. So the book, Law and Addiction, it tells the story that the case that we're actually handling across the country, but at the same time, it's entertaining because it reduces it to a fiction.
Mm-hmm. I have interviewed numerous people on the opioid crisis over the years, the building crisis over the last 5-6 years, Mike. I often say, and I want to get your feeling on this, I often say that one thing I think we have to be careful of in this, because I've heard this from people, and I've heard this from doctors, that for a certain percentage of people, in fact, our attorney general here in Connecticut says he's keeping this in mind as well, certain percentage of people need opioids. It might not be that big, but I have talked to people who have tried everything and everything under the sun, from naturopathic things to modern pain clinics. And for a small amount of people and a small amount of doctors, opioids are necessary. But the prescribing of these things, as you probably contend, has gone crazy.
Well, what's happened is, you understand, this was a drug. These are narcotics. I mean, we've known about the dangers of opioids for 1,000 years. I mean, there's nothing unique about this type of narcotic opioid. So the reason it was put on the market to begin with was exactly the thing that you're talking about. It's breakthrough pain. It's end-of-life kind of problems. It's unique kind of situations. But that wasn't enough for the industry. The industry wanted to sell more, so they came up with what we call an off-label approach, and that's to go to doctors and tell a doctor that, look, we have this literature that says that our opium is different from the opium that that plagued China, for example, 2,000 years ago. Our opium's different. And the way they did that, Paul, is they went out and they found what we call bioaustitute. A bioaustitute is a scientist or a doctor who will sign off on anything for the right amount of money. So what ended up happening is the industry understood they couldn't make enough money selling this drug for what it was supposed to be used for. And what you're describing is exactly what it was supposed to be used for. And so in the end, it will circle back to that. But when the FDA took a look at this, this wasn't, hey, I'm going to give this to somebody with a broken ankle or a tooth being removed. It was never intended for that, but the industry created that myth that you can take 90 of these and be just fine. Well, the truth is, you take it for 7 days and your body is already moving into an addiction mode with dopamine receptors that are reacting to the drug in 7 days. So, you know, it's kind of a seductive argument that you're making here because we're hearing it from the industry. Oh, gee, there's people that are suffering. There's no question that is the case. But you know what? The market has got to correct itself, and this is not a reason to give a get out of trouble free pass to the people who engineered this purely for a bottom dollar money.
And what you just said, and again, it was God, it must have been, I'm thinking back now, it had to be 10 or 15 years ago. I did have to have a tooth extraction. It was a broken tooth. It was a difficult extraction, and you know, my dentist got it out. Now, I'm not a skinny guy. I'm not crazy fat, but I'm not a skinny guy. And I remember at that time, Mike, he gave me a script for three Percocets. Three. And he said, you probably won't need more than one, but I'm going to give you three just in case. Well, you know what? He was right, because I went home, I took one, okay, and I slept for about 10 hours, woke up, most of the pain was gone, and I'm like, holy crap. I'm like, right. there are people hooked. Like, I'm glad it worked, but it was frightening how good it worked, and I'm like, wow, there are people that are hooked on this stuff. How do you get hooked on this stuff and then function? I don't get it.
Well, it's worse, you know. That's a great illustration of exactly the problem. Understand, it's almost unbelievable that you have an industry that creates something that is so dangerous. And they've known this isn't a new problem, Paul. People have known about the addictive nature of opium for a very long time. So then you have manufacturers and distributors. And understand, this was not just Purdue. All you hear is Purdue this and Purdue that. There are many manufacturers, and the distributors are also part of this. So you can manufacture a product, but then you have to have somebody go out and sell it door-to-door to doctors. Mm-hmm. So what they did is they created this idea that there's something so unique about our narcotic that you don't have to worry about it. You can give it to them for 90 days, and there's not going to be a problem. And frankly, you know what they did to get there? They phonied up clinicals. They literally phonied up clinical information that showed that, no surprise, this narcotic, this dope, is exactly the dope that we've been talking about for 2,000 years. It's the same opium. There's nothing different. So all it was a sales job. And government didn't do their job to stop it. The media did not do their job to stop it. And the reason why is because the industry was advertising so much. You know, you turn on MSNBC, you see a drug ad every 15, you know, every 8 minutes. So the media didn't do their job, the government didn't do their job, and the industry took care of, they stepped into this huge void where nobody was paying attention, and now as a result we have 150 people that will die today because of this opioid addiction problem that's just encased this entire country. So now it's digging our way out of it.
Radio host, author, lawyer Mike Papantonio is the guest right here on Connecticut Today with Paul Pacelli. So, you know, we have this problem now, and Mike, I see one thing now that is being encouraged. I think, and correct me if I'm wrong, some states are actually trying this legally to limit, drastically cut back the amount of scripts that can be written for these kinds of things, the numbers of actual dosages in the scripts. Is that taking hold at all on a wide scale as one possible solution here?
Paul, it's an unfortunate knee-jerk reaction, and here's why that happened. 8 years ago, you had 25 attorney generals throughout this country. I mean, these were the people that were supposed to be looking out for consumers. These were the attorney generals who said, yeah, we're doing our job. We're the policemen. We're the top-of-the-line policemen for this state. 25 of them got together. They settled the entire program. They literally settled for $19 million. The next day, they declared victory. That was almost 10 years ago. They declared victory. We've done it. We took $19 million. The opioid crisis is over. Rather than going after these companies like they should have, look, they've made $19 million while you and I have been talking. $19 million is a punishment for these people is meaningless. But you have these attorney generals that do what they've so often do. It's the AG usually stands for almost governor. It's the next step.
Yes.
This is just another step to become governor. And so what they did is they used that, and they tried to make it sound like we've solved the problem. Since then, the problem has only escalated because they didn't do their job. You know, and if you're gonna lay blame here, it's very easy to lay blame on all these attorney generals throughout the country who had all of the information they needed, Paul. They had the documents. Mm-hmm. They had the entire trail that showed that what these companies were doing is they were internalizing the criminal diversion They were internalizing the criminal diversion, the pill mills, and all those types of things that we call criminal diversion, internalizing as part of their business plan.
And we continue with author, radio host, noted attorney Mike Papantonio talking about the opioid crisis. And Mike has a new book out, by the way, The Thriller, Law and Addiction. So, Mike, we can hear that you were no fan of what some of these attorneys general were doing before we went to the break there. So what is the next step here? And again, you're right. You started earlier by saying that it's such a confusing story here to keep tabs of. Where is the legal process now standing with this?
Unfortunately, in the U.S., we have determined that corporations should be treated as people. Let's start there. Now, in a situation where we have a drug dealer selling drugs on the street corner, we know probably what's going to happen to that person eventually. They're going to end up, under some type of scrutiny that's well beyond a civil type of scrutiny. Here, what we do in this country is we say, what is it that affects a corporation the most? And unfortunately, it is to take away all of the profits that they've made. Now, here's what happens. These counties and cities that we represent, they have lost hundreds of millions of dollars, depending on where it is, on things like increased police forces, EMT, the cost that goes into increasing EMT, the cost that goes into things like dependency courts, the cost that goes into rehab. Why should taxpayers have to pay for that? You see, the corporations have made all the money. It's called externalizing costs, Paul. And what that means is it's the same thing as, let's take a river that might run through your city. Yeah. If a polluter came in and they threw arsenic in that river and it affected the drinking water for everybody along the river, they might do that because they're trying to save money by not getting rid of their arsenic in the way they should. That's called externalizing cost. And they then look to the taxpayer for that on that river to pay for the cleanup.
Yeah.
This is exactly the same scenario. They have created a toxic river throughout this country. Now they want to keep all of their profits, and they want to pass on the cleanup to taxpayers and the government. And the government, to unfortunately, there are some people in government that said, yeah, we ought to have taxpayers pay for this. It makes no sense. Why would you allow your neighbor to take their toxin and dump it in your pool and they're not being expensed to your neighbor?
So let me ask you something then, Mike. Certain companies you think should be put out of business, people thrown in jail. If you rule the world right now and you were the judge, jury, and I don't want to say executioner, but what would you do?
Well, I believe in capitalism. I think capitalism is one of the best systems in the world. But capitalism has to work in a way where you say to the people that have done untoward kind of bad things, you have to say to them, you know, capitalism says that we should put you out of business and somebody's going to come and replace you that's going to do it right. That's how the system works. If either we believe in the system, Paul, or we don't. Why should we treat these folks and these corporations that made these decisions knowingly? This wasn't an accident, Paul. There was no accident here. This is part of a way to increase profits for 20 years. Year after year. So why should we say to them that we're going to in any way treat you special? So in order to get where you have to go, there has to be something to where 15 years from now, in MBA school at Harvard or Yale, they're talking about what Uncle Frank did and how it cost his company, it bankrupted his company, and we can't do business like that anymore. Unfortunately, we've become a culture that embraces this need for greed. And these kids coming out of MBA school now think that this is the norm. This is how we ought to do business. We have to change that. And in order to change that, sometimes they need the economic death penalty, which is bankruptcy, and to say, we're sorry, somebody else has to take control of this company.
What can we look for? We have a break coming up in about a minute here, but briefly, Mike Papantonio. What can we look for, say, in the next year or two on this? What's your best guess
now? I'll be trying a very important case in Nevada.
Okay.
The case will take place in Nevada. It'll be the first time that the entire story is told, to where the entire public gets to see the documents, and they get to see the videos, and they get to see the depositions. They then get to understand why I might be so outraged about this, as in this discussion, as you can probably tell. They're going to see firsthand what the companies knew, what they covered up, what they failed to tell the American consumers about how dangerous this opioid poison actually was. That'll take place in Nevada. My goal is to be in the trial this year.
Tell my listeners here, if they go out to their local bookstore or go on Amazon or whatever, if they buy your book, Law and Addiction, what kind of a read are they in for?
They'll understand that, first of all, it's entertaining, it's exciting, and as they're reading, as they're turning the pages, they need to understand that those stories in there are actual stories. It's fiction. They're all based on real stories. All the backstories that are told on there are actually events that have happened leading up to this catastrophic event called the opioid epidemic in the United States. So it tells how the stories developed. It tells how the case developed. It tells all the backstories on how we got to where we are now. The next book that comes out is called The Reckoning, and it'll tell the end of the story when this is all over with. But it ends with you understanding how bad the American public has been fleeced by this opioid industry.
I ask this. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
And it leads them to the point to where they really need to ask more questions about the politicians that let it happen, about the media that allowed it to happen, and about the regulators who looked the other way and said, this is just business as usual in America.
And I ask this, Mike, of all my author guests, TV or movie deal on this? What do you think?
It's got the potential.
Okay. Hey, Mike, closing, thank you so much. Do you have a website people can go to?
Yeah, well, it's most of the time Mike Papantonio. If they'll just Google Mike Papantonio, they'll find everything they need to know.
All right, Mike, it's been fascinating. Good luck, sir. Don't be a stranger. Your people have the info from my people, so if you ever want to come on again here in Southern Connecticut, North Shore of Long Island, you let me know, okay?
Thank you, Paul.
Thanks. Appreciate it. There you go. Mike Papantonio, folks, the guest. This, of course, is the 75th observance of the anniversary of D-Day, June 6th, 1944. Obviously, the anniversary of the day that the Allied Expeditionary Force set off to start a final well-choreographed blow against the forces of the Axis powers in Europe. Also, the U.S. fought another front, and they obviously fought the Pacific War against Japan. And I thought today would be a good day to speak to a gentleman who's written a book about a group of American pilots who, in World War II, waged a secret war against Japan. Hence the name of the book, in paperback now, The Flying Tigers, The Untold Story of the American Pilots Who Waged War Against Japan. Our guest is a historian and lawyer based in New York. He's got a doctorate in international relations from Oxford in England, Marshall Scholar, and he's got his J.D. from the Yale Law School. Go Bulldogs, go Yale Blue. Sam Kleiner joins us. Hey, Sam, Paul here in Bridgeport. How are you?
Hi, Paul. Thanks so much for having me on. It's an honor to be here, especially on this anniversary of D-Day.
Thank you. Thank you. The Flying Tigers, you know, I'm kind of a news junkie. I've kind of heard of them, done a little bit of reading on them. This was a select group of guys. And take us back to, first of all, Sam, what made you interested in this? And why did you choose to write this book?
Thank you so much, Paul. My grandfather was a navigator on a B-25 in the Pacific Theater during World War II. And growing up, I would hear stories from him. We'd go out to aviation museums and get to see planes like the B-25 or the P-40. And I just was fascinated by this period in history. And I did my dissertation at Oxford on how America got into World War II, which is a topic that we don't often look at. And came across this fascinating story of the Flying Tigers that listeners might be familiar with from the John Wayne movie, The Flying Tigers. They might be familiar with that iconic shark-faced image of a P-40. But the real story is so much more interesting. It's about how President Roosevelt, before Pearl Harbor, authorized the secret mission of American pilots and American planes to go ahead and fight against the Japanese in China. And I really fell in love with this story when I was at Yale. Very deep down in the basement of an archive, I came across a collection of love letters, if you can believe it, between a nurse in the unit and a pilot. And the pages were crumbling and yellowing, but you could tell this incredible human story. And so I set off on a journey over a couple of years to track down letters, diaries, combat reports, photographs from this nearly forgotten unit. And what emerged from that is the true, authentic story of this incredible, heroic unit that was really helped inspire us in the desperate days after Pearl Harbor and those first days of World War II.
Must have been fascinating, Sam, hearing those stories from your grandfather. I mean, a lot of World War II vets talk, a lot of them don't, but you say he was on board the B-25, what they call the Billy Mitchell, the Mitchell bomber, which was a hell of an airplane during World War II.
Absolutely. It was the plane that was used in the Doolittle raid. So many of the members of the Greatest Generation, these were guys who survived the Great Depression and then served their country admirably. And they came back after World War II and they had families to raise and lives to build. My grandfather owned a small hardware store in Tacoma, Washington. And so many of them, you know, didn't share fully their stories, and I've been fortunate to spend a lot of time with my grandfather hearing about that period. But it was a great letter-writing generation and a great diary-keeping generation, skills that we've certainly lost touch with. And so what I was able to do through working with the Flying Tigers Association and a lot of these families was to come across really lost collections of letters or diaries that have been sitting in people's basements or attics, and you get in the book then to see from the own words of these young men who were fighting the first battles of World War II, not only what they did, but how they were feeling about it. And so you really get to form these unique emotional bonds with the pilots, many of whom became quite famous, were really household names in those opening days of World War II.
Sam Kleiner is the guest. Sam was able to go through some archives at Yale. And Sam, you talk about the letters that you were able to see from these pilots. You know, I talked with somebody a few weeks ago, a guest here, about how other generations, Sam, our grandparents and our great-grandparents, dating back to the Civil War, if you saw that great Civil War special by Ken Burns, the ability of these, you know, supposedly blue-collar, some of them uneducated, you know, the common man, the ability of them to put words and emotions pen to paper is fascinating.
Yeah, it's remarkable. And the unit that I'm writing about, the Flying Tigers, really had guys who came from all different walks of life. Some had been educated at places like Yale and Princeton. Many were farm boys who, you know, had scarcely left the towns they grew up in. And they all were able to, from what I've seen, write remarkable letters home, keep remarkable introspective diaries. And so it's really a rich topic to be able to write about. It's been a real honor to earn the trust of these families to be able to be the first historian to see these documents and bring that to light. And now, as we talked about, yeah, you know, we're losing so many members of this Greatest Generation, and now there's only one surviving member of the Flying Tigers left, and I've been able to spend a lot of time with him, which has been really fortunate. And one of the honors of writing this was to be able to go give him a book and when he lives down in Columbus, Georgia, and ensure him that the legacy of the Flying Tigers would live on for generations to come.
He must have been thrilled when he made contact with you and when you gave him that book.
Yeah, it's been a really special part of this relationship, and one of the more remarkable things in writing was that we got to go out to a museum in Georgia that has one of these P-40s, and getting to see him reconnect with this plane, it was like a long-lost friendship that was being rekindled in front of my eyes. So many of these guys would go on to do all sorts of different things after the war, but there was some inherent pride they had in being a Flying Tiger or in wherever the Greatest Generation served. And it's a real honor for me as a millennial to pay tribute to that generation through writing this book.
So take us back. You said FDR, President Roosevelt, and I've been watching and listening to his fireside chats over the past few months, because the run-up to World War II, look, a lot of people thought he did, I think, obviously, Sam, he in his heart knew that there would probably be some American involvement. You know, he'd been talking long time with Winston Churchill, and he saw what was going on in England. So you're saying that he formed this before the American involvement, which began with Pearl Harbor.
Exactly right. And I think, you know, when we learn about World War II in history classes, we learn that it began December 7, 1941, with the attack on Pearl Harbor. But the truth is actually much more complicated. Of course, Great Britain was already fighting against Nazi Germany, which had taken over much of Europe. And China and Japan were already at war with the Japanese invasion in 1937. And so Roosevelt was faced with a very isolationist Congress that had passed the Neutrality Acts designed to keep us out of another world war, mm-hmm. and a public that really didn't want to get involved in another world war. And so he was taking what he called measures short of war to help the Allies. And in the Pacific, that took on the form of essentially setting up this secret unit where you had 100 American pilots from the different service branches who officially left the military. So they were civilians, and they were given 100 P-40 planes made by Curtiss Wright up in Buffalo, New York. And these young men and some women traveled across the Pacific on civilian ocean liners, wearing civilian clothes and actually carrying passports listing false professions to disguise their mission. They get over there. They're setting up, training on these planes. And Pearl Harbor happens on December 7, 1941. And they then go into combat just weeks later. Their first battle is on December 20th, 1941, over Kunming, China, which was one of the important cities that was still free in China. And though most Americans probably couldn't pinpoint Kunming on a map, had never heard of it, it quickly became one of the early rallying cries for the country, because after the devastating attack on Pearl Harbor, there was a real sense that we weren't going to be able to win this two-front war. And suddenly you have this kind of motley crew essentially behind enemy lines fighting back and winning. And, of course, Hollywood recognized a good story and rushed out the John Wayne movie in 1942, The Flying Tigers.
How were these pilots selected, Sam? What have you been able to gather on that?
Well, it's a fascinating story. A lot of these guys were just adventurers. They were recruiters who were sent out to different military bases around the country. I read about one of the more famous pilots from the unit is Greg Pappy Boyington.
Oh yeah, yeah.
The Baba Black Sheep show on NBC in the 70s, where he's played by Robert Redford.
Robert Redford,
Boyington's kind of down on his luck. He's stationed at a naval base in Florida, goes into a bar one night, starts talking to the guy next to him, talking about how his wife left him. He's really in debt. He's worried he's essentially going to get sidelined in the Navy as a pilot. And the guy says, "Your lucky day. There's a guy recruiting pilots to go fly in China, and you're going to get paid a lot of money." And he goes up and talks with the guy, and he thinks, you know, there's a lot of bull being given to him. But he says, you know, I was ready to go just about anywhere. So he signs up. So it's that kind of sense of adventure and foolhardiness that comes with youth that drives a lot of these guys. And a lot of them had scarcely left the town they grew up in. I read a lot about a pilot from Iowa named Bill Reed, who's still legendary in Iowa. But he had barely, you know, left the state by the time he signed up. And they take trains out to San Francisco, get on these ocean liners to cross the Pacific, leaving behind an America that was still at peace to enter into this war they knew nothing about.
And Sam, it's amazing too, and I'm not sure the ages of some of these guys, will probably be older, but it's amazing when you do any sort of historical research regarding World War II and the people who got into the service and made an impact, how really young some of them were. And, you know, we think of big military people being in their late 20s and early 30s and 40s and 50s, but the World War II generation, so many of these guys were really young. I mean, younger than some of our kids.
Yeah, a lot of these guys were, you know, early 20s. They wanted to see more of the world. One of the pictures, and I have a lot of personal pictures in the book that came from the families is of a pilot named Jack Newkirk, who was from Scarsdale, New York, and they called him Scarsdale Jack. And it's a picture of him standing on the dock in San Francisco with his wife, a woman he had just married, knowing that he was going to leave for this mission. And that would be the last time they would be together. He was in his early 20s, and he was killed on a mission in Thailand in March 1942. And it was a headline news story across the country because his exploits become so famous through his letters home. And so you know, part of what I wanted to do was to ensure that men like Jack Newkirk, who gave their life for the country and, you know, had been forgotten as time was passed, got their due. And so honoring their legacy was a big part of what I wanted to do in the book.
A couple of minutes remaining. Sam, we got a listener who called in off air, wanted to know the role of Claire Lee Chenault in the Flying Tigers, and did he fly a P-47?
So Claire Chenault is one of the main characters in the book, and he's the commander of the unit. He's a fascinating character who was an Army stunt pilot who left behind his wife and 8 children to go fight in China in, as far back as 1937, so 4 years before Pearl Harbor. He becomes the commander of the Flying Tigers and then commands the 14th Air Force through the war in China. He was a pilot, though there's some debate over how much combat he really did during World War II. Mm-hmm. But the Flying Tiger was really his brainchild, and I was able to get access to his diary and a lot of amazing photos of him. And this was really his vision. He was kind of a bridge between China and the U.S. during the war. And we tend to not really think of China a lot when we think of World War II. And part of what I wanted to do with this book was to bring back that theater of the war, the China-Burma-India theater, and really give readers a sense of what was going on in that really forgotten part of the war.
What was the reaction of the Japanese to this, Sam? Obviously, did this catch them by surprise? Did they know, hey, what are the Americans doing here, or did they have intel, or did they know what was happening short order?
Well, it's a great question. You know, the Japanese were very aware of the threat from the U.S. Once they dragged us into the war. This unit, you know, they were used to being able to bomb cities with relative impunity. And once you have the Flying Tigers in combat, that certainly made a big impact in the fighting in these places. And the unit played a very important role in helping to stem the tide of the Japanese invasion of China that was coming up through the Burma Road. And they played an important role in the defense of Burma, working with our British allies. So it's really a fascinating theater of the war that we don't typically pay much attention to. And you kind of get to see what's going on in the war and in China as well as in Burma, India, Thailand, and Vietnam, areas that we, you know, don't really think of as being part of World War II, but played a really essential role in the war.
When did the American public in general become aware of the Flying Tigers, Sam, and what they were doing?
Well, really, it was a secret mission, but word quickly got out that you had these pilots leaving to go over there. And then the name The Flying Tigers was really coined in a Time magazine article in December 1941, describing their first battle in Kunming, China. Officially, they were known as the American Volunteer Group, but The Flying Tigers was a lot catchier, and that was the name of.
You know, Sam, in closing here, it's a fascinating thing. I always say the more we think we know about World War II, we invariably get these additional stories or retellings of stories and people and places in the war that we thought we knew all about.
Yeah, I think that, you know, the history is changing and it's alive, and you can really learn a lot more through new tellings of it. And so it was exciting for me to be able to work on a new and different perspective on it.
So, Sam, thank you. We appreciate it. And good luck to you.